Welcome to Victory Over Communism with Bill Gertz, the only program willing to pull back the curtain of communism to reveal how China and even America's own brand of Marxism pose real threats to freedom and democracy in America and the world today. Your host and guide to victory over communism is one of the nation's most experienced national security journalists, Bill Gertz, who uses unique facts, pinpoint analysis, and exclusive interviews to identify and counter today's destructive communist ideologies. Now, Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz.
Welcome to the podcast. The VOC podcast is a program about ideology, Chinese communist ideology, and American Marxism. It's not about people. All people are free to believe in whatever they choose. Unfortunately, many people in the United States and the world have been taken in by the false ideology of communism. Millions of people have been fooled by its tenets, and those advocating for a communist revolution employ deception to hide their beliefs. One of the key features of communism and Marxism is the notion of historical materialism. This is the idea that history is on an unstoppable march toward an ideal workers' paradise. This ideal will never be reached because it is based on false assumptions. One, that capitalism is an evil that must be destroyed, and second, that there is no God. The VOC podcast is my effort to provide a clear critique of Marxist-Leninist ideology, followed by a Judeo-Christian-based counterproposal that emphasizes the existence of God. I also include a news section that addresses a different topic related to the two materialist ideologies, and then I conclude with an interview with an expert or influencer. This episode examines the roots of Chinese communism and its dramatic revival under current Chinese Communist Party Supreme Leader Xi Jinping, a hardline communist who is now seeking the expansion of Chinese communism beyond China's borders in a relentless drive to achieve world domination. Communism's theoretical founder, Karl Marx, believed communist revolution in overthrowing the capitalist system was not going to take place in China. This was because China, during Marx's time, was an agrarian, largely illiterate, non-European culture, vastly different from the revolutionary conditions at the time in Germany and Britain. Still, some traditional Chinese philosophies like Taoism and Confucianism seemed to fit well with Marx's ideology. They were somewhat exploited by the Chinese communist founder Mao Zedong, who ruthlessly imposed his brand of communism on the Chinese people and culture with devastating results. Under communism in China, tens of millions of people were killed or died, and the remnants of Mao's political police and military state today are the foundation for what I consider a new brand of high-tech totalitarianism, a system dictated by the Chinese Communist Party that seeks complete control over China's 1.4 billion people and all aspects of their lives. Johnny Thompson, a British philosopher who runs the popular Instagram account Mini Philosophy, notes that European political tradition is based on the idea of the first virtue of justice. From the Magna Carta to the neo-Marxist Black Lives Matter movement, justice is a key motivating factor in political discourse and action. The idea is that each person contains within themselves an inviolability founded on justice. This idea has led to the policy that the welfare of society cannot sacrifice the few for the many, or do wrong in the name of a greater good, since doing so would go against the traditional idea of justice. Chinese intellectual history, by contrast, views harmony as a much greater virtue to be pursued. China's four major philosophical traditions, legalism, Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism, all argue in favor of protecting the integrity and welfare of the entire community rather than the individual. Strife, discord, and separatism are bad. Politeness, respect, and unity are good. In many respects, these concepts of justice and harmony seem incompatible, but in Marxism, they are able to find common ground. Lao Tzu's Taoism argues that everything in the universe is locked in a cosmic embrace with its opposite, With yin and yang, you have two fundamentally different forces that work off one another to create everything in the world. All change and progress are the communication between these opposites. Slight changes in wording were applied by Marxists to their concept of the dialectic of constant struggle producing progress. Thus, the Chinese communists replaced yin and yang with Marx's thesis and antithesis, leading to synthesis. Differences still remain. Marx viewed opposites as locked in a struggle and conflict, while Taoism regards them as in harmony. Confucianism, as well, provided a philosophical basis for Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics first advanced by Mao. Confucius was revolutionary in his day for taking on elitism and authoritarianism. The Confucian emphasis on reciprocity and universal respect, regardless of social position, was easily translated into the slogan, "Workers of the World Unite." That's what originated from Marxists in Europe. Also, Confucianism is largely communitarian. It posits that a person cannot exist or reach completion when in isolation and must take their place within a social body. Chinese thought does not completely eliminate the individual. Instead, Chinese philosophical culture argues that a person's highest interest and development can only be achieved within the larger community. It's this view of people as defined by the whole that has lent itself to a centralized, totalitarian form of communist government operating today in China. This is why the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, insists it is the representative of the Chinese people, and was so incensed during the Trump administration when the Communist Party was separated from the Chinese people as part of an official U.S. policy. A major failure of people outside China has been that so many today believe communist ideology plays no major role in the affairs of the People's Republic of China, the formal name for Communist China. Chinese communism, it needs to be understood, is its own ideology with two unique features. First, Marx believed history was an economic inevitability, while Mao believed ideology was by far the greater driver of history. For Mao, class was not some economic factor, but rather one of beliefs, values, and ideology. A class struggle, then, need not be the factory workers versus the owners, but rather could exist within factory workers themselves. There could even be a class struggle within the heart of an individual. Second, Marx viewed class struggle as moving towards a utopian resolution involving the victory of the sainted working class, culminating in a classless, peaceful communist society. Mao, by contrast, believed all things in life coexist and are defined by opposites. There is no resolution or synthesis for Mao, but permanent revolution and struggle, a point that also differentiates Mao from the Taoism of Lao Tzu. As Johnny Thompson put it, in many ways, the second follows from the first. If class is defined as the political and personal values we all have, it makes sense to assume there will never be an easy resolution. The need to hoard and the need to share, the need to lead and the need to be led, these all war within us. Historically, China was not arranged for ready-made revolutionaries waiting around to hear the Maoist way forward. Mao's seizing of power was defined by war. Supporters of the ousted Republican government of Chiang Kai-shek were exiled, imprisoned, or killed. Rival revolutionary groups were purged. It was the disastrous Cultural Revolution of 1969 onward that sought to establish the philosophy of Maoism as the only ideology of China. During the Cultural Revolution, as many as 1.6 million people were killed as part of Mao's purge of the so-called Four Olds: custom, culture, habit, and ideas. Tibetans were denied all religious practice as monasteries were destroyed. Uyghur Muslims were banned from reading Arabic texts leading to the current genocide in Xinjiang and Western China. All the traditional Chinese philosophies were suddenly enemy ideologies. The People's Republic of China had no room for Taoist or Confucian political thought. Today, Xi Jinping's revival of Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics for the new era, as the term goes, is seeking national rejuvenation and one China. That has always been a lie. China was never and is still not today ideologically homogenous, despite forcing the 94 million CCP members to regularly be tested on Chinese communism on their smart devices. Today, competing ideologies to communism are ruthlessly suppressed. Christians have been driven underground from their home and their home churches bulldozed. The Buddhist group Falun Gong has been ruthlessly repressed after a decade ago having members within senior ranks of the Chinese Communist Party itself. China's constitution at one time claimed to permit freedom of religious belief. That was altered in the 2022 version of the constitution that now states the party shall fully implement its basic policy on religion and encourage religious believers to contribute to economic and social development. For Chinese communists, religion remains, as Marx first described it, the opiate of the masses and must be eradicated, like Islam among the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. As I noted earlier, a denial of God is the central feature of all communist and Marxist ideologies. Marx saw God-centered religion as an ideological tool used by capitalists to stay in power. As will be explained in the counterproposal section, God is the ultimate source of truth and love, who has been separated from humankind by the mistakes of our historical ancestors. Xi Jinping stated in a recent CCP study session that the party must create history by arming the whole party and by adapting Marxism to the Chinese system and use it to guide practice. It's not just a belief, it's a guide to action. This is the key point of communist ideology. Xi is now promoting his materialist ideology throughout the world in several announced initiatives. They include the Global Civilization Initiative, the Global Development Initiative, and the Global Security Initiative. All are being advanced under the Global Belt and Road Initiative, a kind of ideological Trojan horse for the advancement of Chinese communism. Bradley Thayer, a China expert, recently addressed the role of Chinese communism in an article published in Epoch Times. The current Cold War between the Chinese regime and the United States is fundamentally an ideological one rooted in the regime's communist ideology. Communism is innately aggressive by its own logic, as it must destroy alternative political ideologies and polities. It is brutal in its suppression of human freedoms and liberties because Marxism-Leninism is an illegitimate political system with no mandate from the people. Coercion is the tool used most to maintain its iron grip on power. Thus, the Chinese Communist Party is unable to accept any other ideologies that differ from Marxism-Leninism, and all must be ruthlessly defeated. The Chinese regime's current Cold War is actually the continuation of the war against the West waged by the communists since the Bolsheviks seized power in Russia in 1917. It is imperative that American leaders and the American people clearly understand CCP ideology and its role in the long-term ideological struggle. Under Mao's view of constant struggle and revolution, the Chinese regime is now waging low-level ideological and non-kinetic warfare against the United States. The objective is ultimately to achieve the goal of victory, the advancement of Chinese communism, and the replacement of the United States by China as the dominant power in international politics. It is the U.S. model of political liberalism, capitalism, and a society and future defined by freedom that remains the most significant threat to the communist regime's existence and its justification for totalitarian one-party rule. Xi Jinping revealed these goals during his address to the 20th Communist Party Congress in October 22. He declared that CCP had become a moderately prosperous society and now move to achieve the second goal for the next 100 years, building China into a modern socialist state in all respects while advancing the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. This means China now sees itself First, as capable of achieving its aim of supplanting the United States and replacing the liberal international order, and second, that such actions would be legitimate. The modern Marxist-Leninist state will set all the rules. Second, Xi was steadfast that the ideology of the CCP remains firmly anchored in Marxism and its guiding role for the party. Xi is a firm believer in communist ideology. He seeks to strengthen the ideological purity of the CCP while strengthening its control over China and influence in the world. Third, belligerence was the order of the day in Xi's speech last October. He railed against the United States with denunciations of hegemonism and implicitly attacked its allies, the United States, in addition to the United States, Japan, and partners like India. Most explicitly, Xi's aggressive intent was directed against Taiwan and the United States. He believes Marxism-Leninism from China must now lead the world as a true believer in communism. The truth about communism is that it is an abomination that has imposed tyranny and inflicted a horrific price on great peoples and civilizations from China to Cambodia, Angola to East Germany, and Russia to Spain. We need to understand this threat and once again defeat the most dangerous ideology of the 21st century, Chinese communism, just as Americans did in the last century in sending the Soviet system to the ash heap of history. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
Hi, this is Bill Gertz. I wanted to talk to you briefly about my latest book. It's called Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. This is the most important book you can read to fully understand the threat posed by the Chinese Communist government. I urge you to get a copy today. It can be found at my website, The Gertz File, that's GertzFile.com, or at the book site called DeceivingTheSky.com.
If you enjoy listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, please consider helping Bill with his important work of educating patriots just like you about how communism is very real and even more dangerous than ever before. Your donation to the Victory Over Communism program will help expand its reach across America and throughout the world. In fact, you'll be helping to provide the kind of information that may well make its way behind the new Iron Curtain and the Great Firewall of China and inspire those living under communism to seek freedom. Supporting the Victory Over Communism program is easy. Just visit the program website, victoryovercommunism.net, and click on the link at the bottom to GoFundMe.com. Again, just visit victoryovercommunism.net and click on the link to GoFundMe.com. Thanks for listening, and God bless America.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. This is the counterproposal section of the podcast that seeks to go beyond just a critique of communism and Marxism by offering a new vision that can address the problems communism falsely claims will be solved by its ideology. The VOC worldview, as I call it, is based on the teachings of the late Reverend Sun Myung Moon, who brought a new and unique understanding of God, humankind, and the universe that is gradually being recognized as a fundamental and powerful new truth. In the year I've been doing the VOC podcast, I've presented what I believe are very convincing concepts and principles that will provide each of you with powerful tools for countering the false and destructive ideologies of communism and Marxism. I'd now like to summarize the overall conclusion of the VOC worldview. The worldview argues that profound change is needed for the world. It doesn't just call for maintaining the status quo. In his critique of communism, Reverend Moon emphasized Marxism's ideological shortcomings. This contrasted with criticism of Marxism from towering figures like Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Robert Conquest, and Richard Wurmbrand, who tended to focus mainly on the enormity of the atrocities committed by the Marxist-Leninist system. In the case of Solzhenitsyn and Conquest, their writings also occasionally explored the character flaws of communism's leaders, including Lenin and Stalin. On certain occasions, Solzhenitsyn also powerfully commented eloquently on the ideological bankruptcy of communism. But he also felt no need to formulate a systematic, comprehensive critique of Marxism-Leninism. Critiques of Marxism's deeds and protagonists were important in revealing the sinister dimension of Marxism. Yet such approaches could be blunted in some intellectual circles by the moral equivalence argument that sought to play down communism's excesses by pointing to the shortcomings of the anti-communist side as well. In his approach to communism and countering it, Reverend Moon chose to focus on developing and popularizing an analysis and critique of Marxism-Leninism's underlying tenets. From his own life experience, he had come to view the Marxist ideology itself as the Achilles heel of communism, having concluded that the Marxist positions on alienation, dialectical materialism, and historical materialism were scientifically and philosophically invalid. His exposure to this theory and its consequences had been extensive, having worked as a missionary in North Korea from June 1946 to December 1950. This period included 2 years and 8 months in a concentration camp in Hungnam, North Korea, where he, like other prisoners, was subjected to required indoctrination in Marxism. But in contrast to Marxism-Leninism, the VOC worldview proposes a fundamental change. This is not a change in a system, but a change in humans, an internal, self-directed change. Systems are created by humans, but changing humankind, then, there will be a change in the realm of the cause. This change will bring about changes in the realm of effect. The economic system, the social structure, and the method of government are all in the realm of effect. The VOC worldview promotes the principle that unless humans change, nothing changes. Structures are made by humans. Humans must change. Most importantly, humans cannot change without God. The VOC worldview agrees with Marxism on one single point. That is, human alienation is real, and therefore a solution is needed. From this point on, however, Marxism and the VOC worldview are as different as night and day. First, Marx viewed alienation as an economic event, perhaps because he saw human alienation manifested clearly in humans' economic activity. He believed that the root of the problem was there. He therefore believed that the solution must be the abolition of private property. In fact, as we have seen, abuses in the economic arena are but one symptom of a fundamental human problem. Marxism deals with the symptoms, not the disease. The root of the human problem is humans' separation from God, called spiritual alienation. Spiritual alienation requires a spiritual solution. In religious terms, human beings need salvation. Human salvation is not something abstract. Neither is it a sensation or some sort of emotional experience. Salvation means that the relationship between God as Father and humankind as children is completely restored. So, where do we begin? The union of each person with God is our ultimate goal. As we've said, God is working to bring each person into unity with Him by stimulating the human conscience. Our conscience guides each one of us towards moral value. Our journey to God is therefore the journey to a higher perspective of moral value. How do we raise our perspective of value? Only truth can elevate our perspective of value and lift us up to a higher viewing point. The process of raising our perspective of value in response to truth can be called a spiritual awakening. The journey to the highest perspective of value must begin by searching for a new expression of truth. This is the point of departure for the VOC worldview. Human history is the journey of humankind toward God. Certainly at the outset of creation, God endowed men and women with the power to know Him. His desire was not only that they know him, but that they dwell with him and share every day with him in a relationship of love. Men and women are intended to live with a constant awareness of God. This would not require any extraordinary effort, such as prayer and fasting, but would be easy as feeling the warmth of the sun or recognizing our own parents. The fall of humankind, the separation of humans from God, deprived God and humans of that closeness. Whatever particular interpretation you may gain from the biblical description of the fall, the results of humans separating from God are clear. Knowledge of God was lost, and darkness fell over the human mind. From that moment, humankind's long journey in search of God began. This journey is not completed in a single step. In fact, the human race has made many steps ranging over many thousands of years. Each step takes us closer to the day when we can emerge gradually from the darkness and see the shining sun, God. The Bible describes distinctive steps in the process of humankind knowing God. In ancient times, for example, human understanding of God was very primitive. People worshipped idols, and the concept of a monotheistic God was strange to them. Abraham, the son of Terah, an idol maker, was inspired by God to begin a new religious tradition. That tradition is the Hebrew faith. Abraham rejected his father's idols and prayed to the one God. The story of Abraham is one of the great stories of human faith. Ultimately, Abraham was asked to sacrifice that which was most precious to him, his son Isaac. Abraham demonstrated absolute faith and obedience to God. He was even willing to kill Isaac on Mount Moriah. At that moment, God stopped Abraham, saying, "Now I know that you fear the Lord." In the early stage of human history, then, God was seen as an object of fear. The way people related to him was through offerings. This was the extent to which God could teach about himself at that time. Later came the Bible story of Moses. How did God relate to his people in Moses' time? We can compare it to the way a parent would relate to a young child, just as a parent would guide his child by prescribing what the child should and should not do. God guided his people by giving them Mosaic law. This age might be called the age of law. By telling his people what to do and what not to do, God hoped to guide them along the path toward him. In this age, God reigned over humankind as the Lord of the hosts of heaven, with humankind in the position of servant. Christ came 16 biblical centuries after Moses. In contrast to the Mosaic law, the teachings of Jesus brought religion to a new stage of faith and love. When asked which is the greatest commandment, Jesus replied, "You shall love your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets." That's from Matthew 22:37-10. It was through Christ that God was treating men and women as a loving parent would treat his adolescent children. Rather than simply prescribe what they should do, he respects that they have reached a certain degree of maturity, and he challenges them to show their faith and love for him by loving one another. Jesus Christ emphasized the profound truth that God is our Father and men and women are his children. What about the present age? In the 2,000 years that have elapsed since the birth of Jesus, human civilization achieved a phenomenal level of advancement. Men walked on the moon, and the internet has revolutionized what we know and how we communicate. Human intellectual capacity has developed far beyond what anyone could have imagined. Along with this, humankind's capacity to learn and understand the truth of God has also progressed. How will God reveal himself to modern men and women? What stage have we now reached along the road of knowing God? The VOC worldview is very clear on this point. God wants each of us to take the final steps in the path back to God. This can be achieved when we come to know God intimately and profoundly. The present age is the age of the actualization of deeper relationships with God. Each of us is called to be a child of God, to be a temple of God, to be a saint. This was the goal for humans from the very beginning. Now, all the trends of historical development indicate that this goal can soon be achieved. When men and women become what they originally should have become, the commandments of religion will be unnecessary. When someone becomes an embodiment of truth, every action is naturally pleasing to God, and the extraordinary demands of religious life would no longer be needed. It is the will of God that all men and women become like Christ. All men and women are destined to achieve sainthood. When this is the case, what kind of society would be created? This could only be called the ideal society. Certainly, the dwelling of God would be with all humankind. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters.
Welcome back. For the news section of the program, I'm going to discuss recent events in China that are troubling indicators showing how greater Marxist-Leninist ideological controls are being imposed as part of Supreme Leader Xi Jinping's program of totalitarian communism. Beginning in late April 2023, Chinese security and political police began a major crackdown, not just on Chinese companies, but on foreign companies doing business in China as well. The action against foreign businesses comes only a few months after communist authorities began a campaign to attract global investors in China in an effort to counter the sharp downturn in the economy following the harsh Communist Party-inspired anti-pandemic controls, the so-called zero COVID policies. A shock action took place in recent weeks with security authorities questioning the staff of the consulting firm Bain & Company at the Shanghai office during a surprise visit. This is an American company. A cybersecurity probe was also carried out on the microchip manufacturer Micron Technology, Inc., related to imports of chips, and an employee of a Japanese drug maker, Astellas Pharma, Inc., was detained on questionable charges. Communist political police also raided the Beijing office of the U.S. due diligence company called the Minsk Group. The crackdown is ostensibly the result of a new counter-espionage law aimed at perceived foreign threats. The law allows police to inspect baggage and electronic devices of those suspected of espionage, in a move that significantly increases the risk for Western companies doing business in China. The crackdown is motivated by Chinese communist ideology that fears foreign interaction as bringing with it ideological subversion, namely capitalism, free markets, free speech, freedom of religion, and all those. As part of the CCP's reform and opening up policy that began in the late 1980s, foreign businesses were encouraged and attracted into China. It was this policy that produced the phenomenal growth of China's economy. Now, under Xi, an ideological retrenchment is underway that seeks to return to the Chinese communist and Maoist policies espoused by Marx and introduced by Lenin. The Chinese leader is acting on his distrust of capitalist forces that had driven the party campaign to rein in the private sector and place it under stricter party control. The drive is based on mounting anti-American sentiment expressed in recent speeches by Xi Jinping, attacking the United States and its capitalist system for causing China's economic and other woes. In line with Xi's criticism, authorities are shifting their focus into coercing American and other foreign companies to fall in line with party diktats. All foreigners, especially Americans, who have permits to work in China are said to be targets of the campaign that has included interrogations and other types of questioning that those who have experienced them say are signs that the police assume they are government agents. Business executives who interact with Chinese authorities say the central impetus for the crackdown is Beijing's desire to more tightly control the narrative about China's communist system and plans for expanding while limiting the information collected by foreign companies such as auditors, management consultants, and law firms that could influence how the outside world views China. This is, again, a drive for totalitarian control. The Chinese coercion of American firms comes as the Biden administration has been seeking to warm its relations over fears of a future conflict and to help American companies to continue making money in China, a questionable assumption because it's been very difficult for these companies to do business there. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, once a main booster of doing business in China, recently warned that China's pressure on American firms in China dramatically increases uncertainties and risks of doing business in the so-called Middle Kingdom. The influential business lobby, the Chamber of Commerce, issued a statement saying it is closely monitoring what it termed heightened official scrutiny of U.S. firms by the Chinese authorities. The statement came after authorities questioned Bain employees and shut down the Beijing office of the Minsk Group. The services these firms provide are fundamental to establishing investor confidence in any market, including China, the Chamber said in a statement without naming either company. The amendment to the counter-espionage law in China will go into effect in July and expands the authorities' power to investigate national security cases. This is a matter of serious concern for the investor community and likely is as well for the local business partners in China, said the Chamber. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen gave a major speech on China in April that sought to reinvigorate the U.S. policy of engaging China economically. The policy of unfettered engagement with China was rejected during the Trump administration, which dismissed the 40-year-old policy as a disaster for Americans. The Trump White House issued a report on China's economic aggression in 2018. It reveals how Chinese technology spies were stealing between $250 billion and $600 billion annually in technology and intellectual property. Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, insisted in the speech that U.S. national security would be the linchpin of U.S. policy towards China. Yet, in the same remarks, she promised that the United States would not suppress or contain the Chinese economy. Not seeking to restrict China runs against the Biden defense strategy that calls for imposing costs for aggression as a way to deter enemies, and the February 2022 Indo-Pacific strategy that calls for shaping the strategic environment in which China operates in ways favorable to the United States and its allies and partners. The incoherence on China is just one of the weak and ineffective policies of the Biden administration that has sought a dual approach to China of competing and cooperating. Unfortunately, neither of those have produced any tangible benefit for the United States. The root cause of the failed foreign policy approach has been the total misunderstanding of the Chinese communist system that sees itself locked in a global struggle for dominance with the United States. Fundamentally, we don't have a China problem, we have a communist problem, said Matt Taibbi. He's exactly right. We need to really focus and understand and learn the ideological nature of the Chinese communist system and its guiding ideology, which Beijing calls Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics for the new era. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
I spoke to you earlier about my book, Deceiving the Sky. I also wanted to urge you to take a look at another book that I wrote called iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. We live in an information age, and yet we're getting bombarded with enemy propaganda coming at us from all different directions. iWar really helps expose what we need to do and how we need to counter it. I urge you to get a copy. The book can be found at iwarbook.com or at my website, thegertzfile.com.
Thank you. You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. For the interview portion, I'm going to play excerpts of a speech given in July 2020 by then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo at the Nixon Library. Secretary Pompeo helped revolutionize U.S. policy towards China during his tenure as Secretary of State. Here are the excerpts.
My remarks today are the fourth set of remarks in a series of China speeches that I asked National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, FBI Director Chris Wray, and the Attorney General Barr to deliver alongside me. We had a very clear purpose, a real mission, was to explain the different facets of America's relationship with China, the massive imbalances in that relationship that have built up over decades, and the Chinese Communist Party's designs for hegemony. Our goal was to make clear that the threats to Americans that President Trump's China policy aims to address are clear, and our strategy for securing those freedoms established. You know, Ambassador O'Brien spoke about ideology. FBI Director Wray talked about espionage. Attorney General Barr spoke about economics. And now my goal today is to put it all together for the American people in detail what the China threat means for our economy, for our liberty, and indeed for the future of free democracies around the world. But today we're all still wearing masks and watching the pandemic's body count rise because the CCP failed in its promises to the world. We're reading every morning new headlines of repression in Hong Kong and in Xinjiang. We're seeing staggering statistics of Chinese trade abuses that cost American jobs and strike enormous blows to the economies all across America, including here in Southern California. And we're watching a Chinese military that grows stronger and stronger and indeed more menacing. I'll echo the questions ringing in the hearts and minds of Americans from here in California to my home state of Kansas and beyond. What do the American people have to show now, 50 years on, from engagement with China? Did the theories of our leaders that proposed a Chinese evolution towards freedom and democracy prove to be true? Is this China's definition of a win-win situation? And indeed, centrally, from Secretary of State's perspective, is America safer? Do we have a greater likelihood of peace for ourselves and peace for the generations which will follow us? Look, we have to admit a hard truth. We must admit a hard truth that should guide us in the years and decades to come, that if we want to have a free 21st century and not the Chinese century of which Xi Jinping dreams, the old paradigm of blind engagement with China simply won't get it done. We must not continue it, and we must not return to it. American policymakers increasingly presumed that as China became more prosperous, it would open up, it would become freer at home, and indeed present less of a threat abroad. It'd be friendlier. It all seemed, I am sure, so inevitable. But that age of inevitability is over. The kind of engagement we've been pursuing has not brought the kind of change inside of China that President Nixon had hoped to induce. The truth is that our policies and those of other free nations resurrected China's failing economy only to see Beijing bite the international hands that were feeding it. We opened our arms to Chinese citizens only to see the Chinese Communist Party exploit our free and open society. China sent propagandists into our press conferences, our research centers, our high schools, our colleges, and even into our PTA meetings. We marginalized our friends in Taiwan, which later blossomed into a vigorous democracy. We gave the Chinese Communist Party and the regime itself special economic treatment, only to see the CCP insist on silence over its human rights abuses as the price of admission for Western companies entering China. Ambassador Bryan ticked off a few examples just the other day. Marriott, American Airlines, Delta, United all removed references to Taiwan from their corporate websites so as not to anger Beijing. And Hollywood, not too far from here, the epic center of American creative freedom, and self-appointed arbiters of social justice, self-censors even the most mildly unfavorable reference to China. This corporate acquiescence to the CCP happens all over the world, too. And how has this corporate fealty worked? Is its flattery rewarded? I'll give you a quote from the speech that General Barr gave, Attorney General Barr. In his speech last week, he said that the ultimate ambition of China's rulers isn't to trade with the United States, it is to raid the United States. China ripped off our prized intellectual property and trade secrets, causing millions of jobs all across America. It sucked supply chains away from America and then added a widget made of slave labor. It made the world's key waterways less safe for international commerce. President Nixon once said he feared he had created a Frankenstein by opening the world to the CCP. And here we are. Now, people of good faith can debate why free nations allowed these bad things to happen for all these years. Perhaps we were naive about China's virulent strain of communism, or triumphalist after our victory in the Cold War, or cravenly capitalist, or hoodwinked by Beijing's talk of a peaceful rise. Whatever the reason, today China is increasingly authoritarian at home and more aggressive in its hostility to freedom everywhere else. And President Trump has said enough. I don't think many people on either side of the aisle dispute the facts that I've laid out today. But even now, some are insisting that we preserve the model of dialogue for dialogue's sake. Now, to be clear, we'll keep on talking, but the conversations are different these days. I traveled to Honolulu now just a few weeks back to meet with Yang Jiechi. It was the same old story, plenty of words, but literally no offer to change any of the behaviors. Yang's promises, like so many the CCP made before him, were empty. His expectations, I summarize, were that I'd cave to their demands, because frankly, this is what too many prior administrations have done. I didn't, and President Trump will not either. As Ambassador O'Brien explained so well, we have to keep in mind that the CCP regime is a Marxist-Leninist regime. General Secretary Xi Jinping is a true believer in a bankrupt totalitarian ideology. It's this ideology that informs his decades-long desire for global hegemony of Chinese communism. America can no longer ignore the fundamental political and ideological differences between our countries, just as the CCP has never ignored them. My experience in the House Intelligence Committee, and then as director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and my now 2+ years as America's Secretary of State have led me to this central understanding that the only way to truly change communist China is to act not on the basis of what Chinese leaders say, but how they behave. And you can see American policy responding to this conclusion. President Reagan said that he dealt with the Soviet Union on the basis of trust but verify. When it comes to the CCP, I say we must distrust and verify. We, the freedom-loving nations of the world, must induce China to change, just as President Nixon wanted. We must induce China to change in more creative and assertive ways, because Beijing's actions threaten our people and our prosperity. We must start by changing how our people and our partners perceive the Chinese Communist Party. We have to tell the truth. We can't treat this incarnation of China as a normal country just like any other. We know that trading with China is not like trading with a normal law-abiding nation. Beijing threatens international agreements as treats international suggestions as or agreements as suggestions, as conduits for global dominance. But by insisting on fair terms, as our trade representative did when he secured our Phase One trade deal, we can force China to reckon with its intellectual property theft and policies that have harmed American workers. We know too that doing business with a CCP-backed company is not the same as doing business with, say, a Canadian company. They don't answer to independent boards, and many of them are state-sponsored and so have no need to pursue profits. A good example is Huawei. We stopped pretending Huawei is an innocent telecommunications company just showing up to make sure you can talk to your friends. We've called it what it is, a true national security threat, and we've taken action accordingly. We know, too, that if our companies invest in China, they may wittingly or unwittingly support the Communist Party's gross human rights violations. Our Departments of Treasury and Commerce have thus sanctioned blacklisted Chinese leaders and entities that are harming and abusing the most basic rights for people all across the world. Several agencies have worked together on a business advisor to make certain that our CEOs are informed of how their supply chains are behaving inside of China. We know, too, that not all Chinese students and employees are just normal students and workers that are coming here to make a little bit of money and to garner themselves some knowledge. Too many of them come here to steal our intellectual property and to take this back to their country. The Department of Justice and other agencies have vigorously pursued punishment for these crimes. We know that the People's Liberation Army is not a normal army, too. Its purpose is to uphold the absolute rule of the Chinese Communist Party elites and expand a Chinese empire, not to protect the Chinese people. And so our Department of Defense has ramped up its efforts, freedom of navigation operations out throughout the East and South China Seas and in the Taiwan Strait as well. And we've created a space force to help deter China from aggression on that final frontier. And so too, frankly, we built out a new set of policies at the State Department dealing with China, pushing President Trump's goals for fairness and reciprocity to rewrite the imbalances that have grown over decades. Just this week, we announced the closure of the Chinese consulate in Houston because it was a hub of spying and intellectual property theft. We reversed 2 weeks ago 8 years of cheek turning with respect to international law in the South China Sea. We've called on China to conform its nuclear capabilities to the strategic realities of our time. And the State Department at every level, all across the world, has engaged with our Chinese counterparts simply to demand fairness and reciprocity. But our approach can't just be about getting tough. That's unlikely to achieve the outcome that we desire. We must also engage and empower the Chinese people, a dynamic, freedom-loving people who are completely distinct from the Chinese Communist Party. That begins with in-person diplomacy. I've met Chinese men and women of great talent and diligence wherever I go. I've met with Uyghurs and ethnic Kazakhs who have escaped Xinjiang's concentration camps. I've talked with Hong Kong's democracy leaders, from Cardinal Zen to Jimmy Lai. 2 days ago, in London, I met with Hong Kong freedom fighter Nathan Law. And last month, in my office, I heard the stories of Tiananmen Square survivors. You know, I grew up and served my time in the army during the Cold War. And if there's one thing I learned, communists almost always lie. The biggest lie that they tell is to think that they speak for 1.4 billion people who are surveilled, oppressed, and scared to speak out. Quite the contrary, the CCP fears the Chinese people's honest opinions more than any foe. For too many decades, our leaders have ignored, downplayed the words of brave Chinese dissidents and warned us about the nature of the regime we're facing, and we can't ignore it any longer. They know, as well as anyone, that we can never go back to the status quo. But changing the CCP's behavior cannot be the mission of the Chinese people, and free nations have to work to defend freedom. It's the furthest thing from easy. But I have faith we can do it. I have faith because we've done it before. We know how this goes. I have faith because the CCP is repeating some of the same mistakes that the Soviet Union made. Alienating potential allies, breaking trust at home and abroad, rejecting property rights and predictable rule of law. I have faith. I have faith because of the awakening I see among other nations that know we can't go back to the past in the same way that we do here in America. I've heard this from Brussels to Sydney to Hanoi. And most of all, I have faith we can defend freedom because of the sweet appeal of freedom itself. I reject the notion that we're living in an age of inevitability, that some trap is preordained, that CCP supremacy is the future. Our approach isn't destined to fail because America is in decline. As I said in Munich earlier this year, the free world is still winning. We just need to believe it and know it and be proud of it. People from all over the world still want to come to open societies. They come here to study. They come here to work. They come here to build a life for their families. They're not desperate to settle in China. It's time. It's great to be here today. The timing is perfect. It's time for free nations to act. Not every nation will approach China in the same way, nor should they. Every nation will have to come to its own understanding of how to protect its own sovereignty, how to protect its own economic prosperity, and how to protect its ideals from the tentacles of the Chinese Communist Party. But I call on every leader of every nation to start by doing what America has done, to simply insist on reciprocity, to insist on transparency and accountability from the Chinese Communist Party. It's a cadre of rulers that are far from homogenous, and these simple and powerful standards will achieve a great deal. For too long, we let the CCP set the terms of engagement, but no longer. Free nations must set the tone. We must operate on the same principles. We have to draw common lines in the sand that cannot be washed away by the CCP's bargains or their blandishments. Indeed, this is what the United States did recently when we rejected China's unlawful claims in the South China Sea once and for all, as we have urged countries to become clean countries so that their citizens' private information doesn't end up in the hand of the Chinese Communist Party. We did it by setting standards. Now, it's true, it's difficult. It's difficult for some small countries. They fear being picked off. Some of them, for that reason, simply don't have the ability or the courage to stand with us for the moment. Indeed, we have a NATO ally of ours that hasn't stood up in the way that it needs to with respect to Hong Kong because they fear Beijing will restrict access to China's market. This is the kind of timidity that will lead to historic failure. And we can't repeat it. We cannot repeat the mistakes of these past years. The challenge of China demands exertion, energy from democracies, those in Europe, those in Africa, those in South America, and especially those in the Indo-Pacific region. And if we don't act now, ultimately, the CCP will erode our freedoms and subvert the rules-based order that our societies have worked so hard to build. If we bend the knee now, our children's children may be at the mercy of the Chinese Communist Party, whose actions are the primary challenge today in the free world. General Secretary Xi is not destined to tyrannize inside and outside of China forever unless we allow it. Now, this isn't about containment. Don't buy that. It's about a complex new challenge that we've never faced before. The USSR was closed off from the free world. Communist China is already within our borders. So we can't face this challenge alone. The United Nations, NATO, the G7 countries, the G20, our combined economic, diplomatic, and military power is surely enough to meet this challenge if we direct it clearly and with great courage. Maybe it's time for a new grouping of like-minded nations, a new alliance of democracies. We have the tools. I know we can do it. Now we need the will. To quote scripture, I ask, is our spirit willing, but our flesh weak? If the free world doesn't change, Communist China will surely change us. There can't be a return to the past practices because they're comfortable or because they're convenient. Securing our freedoms from the Chinese Communist Party is the mission of our time, and America is perfectly positioned to lead it because our founding principles give us that opportunity. Our nation was founded on the premise that all human beings possess certain rights that are unalienable, and it's our government's job to secure those rights. It is a simple and powerful truth. It's made us a beacon of freedom for people all around the world, including people inside of China. Indeed, Richard Nixon was right when he wrote in 1967 that the world cannot be safe until China changes. Now it's up to us to heed his words. Today, the danger is clear, and today the awakening is happening. Today, the free world must respond. We can never go back to the past. May God bless each of you. May God bless the Chinese people. And may God bless the people of the United States of America.
That's it for this episode. Thanks again for listening. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with a new episode. Please help me promote the program by forwarding the email to as many people as possible. And if you want further information, you can go to my website, victoryovercommunism.net.
thanks for listening to Victory Over Communism with award-winning national security journalist Bill Gertz, the only program in the free world unafraid to pull back the curtain of communism to reveal how the Communist Party of China and even America's own brand of Marxism pose real threats to freedom and democracy in America and the world today. See you next time on Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz.